Well, we have a long lesson this morning. I'm going to get right to it. It's Genesis chapter 13. Could not be a more appropriate reading for this Sunday before Election Day. So Abram went up from Egypt into the Negev. He took his wife and all his possessions with him, as well as Lot. Now Abram was very wealthy in livestock, silver, and gold, and he journeyed from place to place, from south to north. He journeyed to the place where he had pitched his tent at the beginning, between Bethel and Ai. This was the place where he had first built the altar, and there Abram worshipped Yahweh. Now Lot, who was traveling with Abram, also had flocks, herds, and tents, but the land could not support them while they lived side by side. Because their possessions were so great, they were not able to live alongside each other. So there were quarrels between Abram's herdsmen and Lot's herdsmen. Now the Canaanites and the Perizzites were living in the land at the time. Abram said to Lot, "Let there be no quarreling between me and you, and between my herdsmen and yours, for we are close relatives. Is not the whole land before you? Separate yourself from me now. If you go to the left, I'll go to the right, but if you go to the right, I'll go to the left." Lot looked up and saw the whole region of the Jordan, that all of it was well watered. This was before the Lord obliterated Sodom and Gomorrah. Like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt all the way to Zoar. Lot chose for himself the whole region of the Jordan and traveled toward the east. So the relatives separated from each other. Abram settled in the land of Canaan, but Lot settled among the cities of the Jordan plain and pitched his tents next to Sodom. Now the people of Sodom were extremely wicked rebels against Yahweh. After Lot had departed, Yahweh said to Abram, "Look from the place where you stand, to the north, to the south, to the east, and to the west. I will give all the land that you see to you and to your descendants forever. And I will make your descendants like the dust of the earth, so that if anyone is able to count the dust of the earth, then your descendants could be counted. Get up and walk throughout the land, for I'll give it to you." So Abram moved his tents and went to live by the oaks of Mamre in Hebron. And he built an altar to Yahweh there. You're all wondering, what's this got to do with the election? Today we have a story from the life of Abram, or Abraham. Genesis is full of stories, as we know very well by now. So is the rest of the Old Testament. And in fact, the Gospels and the book of Acts also contain many stories. For a culture like that of Israel, a story is like a painting. The artist puts a lot of thought into it before he tells it. He thinks about how he wants the story to flow. He thinks about how he can make the story easy to remember so the listeners can think about it and ponder it long after the story has been told. He thinks about how he can tell it so that his hearers can pass it on to others without missing any of the important details. People who grow up in that same culture learn from the time they are children and stories are told to them what makes a good story. They listen for those cues. They hear much more than the words of the story. They hear the intent of the storyteller. And they know how to discover the story's meaning. And in this way, they learn what's behind the story and why it is told and why the event is worth retelling. Every culture has its own style. And that style can vary from generation to generation. We're not much of a storytelling culture. We don't have time for for carefully crafted stories. Nor do we take the time to truly ponder what stories are telling us. I remember when I was in college, my degree was in English literature, and I went through the various stages of English literature, starting with Chaucer and Canterbury Tales, then on to John Milton and Paradise Lost, and then the plays of Shakespeare, and on into the more modern authors. With each class, with each period of literature, I had to learn the structure that the storytellers of that period used. When I first read William Shakespeare, I had no idea what he was trying to say. The more I learned about the style of Shakespeare's writing, the richer his writing became. It got to the point where every time I would read a play, I would see more in that play. And so it was with other stages of literature. It always seemed to me that the greatest writers were the most boring writers, because I would read a story like Moby Dick. That's a long, long story. And if you don't understand the craft, it's a very boring story. It's like reading the genealogies of the Bible. If you can get your way through the boring narratives, you may actually find a little action in the plot. But once you know what Herman Melville is doing and how he's doing it, you understand why it's considered a classic. But in our culture, storytelling seems to have gone the way of letter writing. You know, the craft of letter writing is something that we don't engage in very much. We're too used to emails. Emails were bad enough, you know, they're short and not very complete. But then we get into texting. Texting not only destroys our sense of storytelling, it destroys our ability to spell. Please forgive me for this joke, but it's very timely in the comics this morning. There's one comic, I don't know which one it is, but one person says to the other, you know, they say when people text, they drop the vowels, the A, E, I, O, and U. And the other guy says, close your ears. Sounds like a vowel movement to me. And that's the way it is. I get texts sometimes, I can't make heads or tails out of it because it's a letter here, a letter there, and usually a smiley face in between. Now, there's nothing wrong with texting. It has helped me out a lot, but it's not letter writing. And I doubt very much that 30 years from now, we'll be looking into our phones and reading all of the texts that we have gotten from people over the years. Like I had been doing this past week, looking over the letters I've received over the past 30 years. Like the letter we got from Gerald after we sent him cookies. And he wrote back and said, the cookies were great. I shared them with all of the guys, and they all say thank you, and I say thank you, and it's nice to be remembered. Yours truly, Gerald. P.S. Tell Mom that turkey, mashed potatoes, and stuffing will be good when I come home. Now that's a letter with a message. But because we have lost the art of storytelling and letter writing, when we come across a well-written story, it often seems boring and maybe even confusing to us. We fail to understand the message and we miss the artistry. We must learn what that culture took for granted if we're to really understand the story. Often when we read the Bible, we get confused by the way it's written. It seems to give details that mean nothing to us. Meanwhile, it raises questions in our mind that the story doesn't answer. We often feel the need to rewrite the story in some way and to add a lot of details so that it makes more sense to us. But in doing so, we only obscure the message. We read stories in the Old Testament and we think we catch the meaning of them. Then we turn to the New Testament where some writer makes mention of that story and seems to get an entirely different message from it than what we did. We wonder, am I missing something? What's the real point behind these stories that I thought I knew? We think the Bible is ours to interpret in any way we want. But in reality, the same God who created the universe according to a design he had in mind beforehand, who called us to be believers in Jesus Christ before the first word of that story was written, has also written the history of salvation according to a certain plan. When we read his words, we need to be looking for his purpose in the writing and not seeking just to please our desire for a good story. As Paul advised Timothy, we must learn how to rightly divide the word of truth, that is, to understand the message accurately and not get caught up in useless chatter and arguments over words, and treating stories like myths that we can rewrite to suit our fancy. It does no good to learn all kinds of things from the Bible, some of them even true, if we end up missing the main purpose for which the story is told. And often it's exactly those aspects of the story that seem so meaningless to us when we're reading the words. Today's lesson, Genesis 13, is a good example. Seems like a family story about Abram and Lot. Carelessly told and not all that important. Just another story on the way to the promises God makes to Abram and the birth of Isaac. But in reality, it's a very carefully crafted account, strategically placed at this point in the overall account of the descendants or generations of Terah, a larger story that goes from Genesis 11, verse 27, to Genesis 25, verse 12. I don't have time right now to describe how this chapter is put together. I will be doing that in Sunday school. And the details that I'll be going over will help to explain not only this story, but many other stories in the Bible, Old and New Testaments. Details that we often find confusing or nonsensical. I urge you to stay for that because it's an important lesson on how to understand the Bible. But right now, I'd like to talk about this chapter. This chapter, like every chapter we've read so far, has many layers and it teaches many lessons. It teaches about the importance of family relationships. It teaches about the need to put harmony ahead of prosperity. It teaches about the importance of being proactive and not waiting for problems to develop. It teaches how the nation of Israel, the descendants of Abram through Isaac and Jacob, is related literally to the descendants of Lot, the Ammonites, and the Moabites, their neighbors as they lived in the land. Each of these lessons is worthy of its own sermon. But the most important lesson, the center of the whole chapter, is a contrast between the character of Lot and the choices that character results in, and the character of Abram and the choices he made because of his character. Abram shows his character first by taking the initiative to head off family disputes that are beginning to arise due to their prosperity. We learn the truth of what James said long ago. Where do wars come from? Wars do not come primarily from conflicts between nations. Wars spring out of conflicting desires within ourselves. We want and we don't get what we want, so we fight for it. We go to take it, and if somebody else doesn't want us to take it, then there's a war. They say all politics is local. Well, all wars are local too. A reflection of the sin nature that's in every one of us. Now, I mentioned that the disputes between Lot and Abram rose because of their prosperity. That may seem strange to you. We're told in school these days that all conflict is the result of poverty. And that if everyone had what they needed, there would be no more war. It seems a simple lesson. The only problem is it's wrong. Human evils do not come from poverty. They come from the human heart, and the human heart works in prosperity as much as it works in poverty. Prosperity brings its own challenges and stirs up its own evil, the evil of greed and the constant lust for more. It is prosperity, not the struggles and poverty of the past, that has ruined our nation and turned it so drastically away from God. So much so that I believe that if we were to face another Great Depression like we had in the 30s, we wouldn't survive, because the character of the nation is different than it was then. And in some ways, it was the character of the nation as God worked through it that brought us through those hard times. We don't have that anymore. We don't have a solidarity as a nation. And we don't have a faith rooted in God. Abram sees conflict building, so he approaches Lot and he offers him first choice at the land that's in front of them. Now, Abram is a man of faith. The whole Bible agrees on that statement. Abram is a man of faith. And it is by his faith that he lives. We're reminded of his faith at the very beginning of this chapter. Abram returned to the place where he had pitched his tent at the beginning, between Bethel and Ai. This was where he had first built an altar. And there Abram worshipped Yahweh. Never are we told in all of Genesis that Lot built an altar or worshipped Yahweh. That's the first difference between the two of them. Last week we saw that Abram didn't trust the Egyptians and actually resorted to deceit in dealing with them. But when it came to family, Abram seemed to follow the same advice God gives in 1 Corinthians 6:7 when he says, "It's better, if it's necessary, to be cheated by your brother than to take advantage of him." Abram lets Lot have the first choice. And Lot, being who he is, acts according to his character. He takes advantage of the choice. The contrast here is between Lot, who makes choices by what his eyes see, choosing the well-watered plain and the prosperous city of Sodom, and not recognizing that Sodom was rebelling against Yahweh. And Abram on the other side, who's left to wander from place to place in Canaan. We may think that Abram got the short end of the stick. But though Lot had eyes for good pasture, he failed to see the greater threat, The fact that even then, as verse 13 tells us, the people of Sodom were extremely wicked rebels against Yahweh. Such extreme wickedness should not have been hard to see. In fact, we can see it all around us. But we become used to it and it doesn't affect us. And we don't see the danger. So too, Lot's eyes were blinded by financial advantage. And he chose according to what looked the most prosperous. This is the risk we take when we see and judge as the world judges and not as God would have us judge. The danger to Lot and the evil that he has exposed himself to because of his choice will become plain as we continue reading in Genesis, in both the next chapter and in chapter 18. But we don't have to wait to see the blessing that comes to Abram in response to his trust in God and in putting family peace ahead of financial prosperity. Before the chapter is over, God restates his covenant with Abram, expressed in his promise to give Abram descendants as numerous as the dust on the earth, and a land that will be his and his descendants forever. That promise is the reason why, after 2,000 years of exile, God has brought Israel back to the land that he promised to give them. And even today, there are Christians who claim that God is done with Israel, and he only cares about the church. But the promise God made was based on his character, and one attribute of God that we've learned in Bible study is that God is eternal. The promise was not just for a generation, and it did not depend on the faithfulness of Abram or his descendants. It was a promise founded on nothing but the character of God, as we'll see again in chapter 15. A covenant that, in the words of the prophets, is as sure as the sun rising in the east and the changing phases of the moon. Did you see the moon last night? Big, beautiful orange full moon. Every month, give or take a day or two, the new moon rises as the sun is setting. The prophet Jeremiah says, if 2 months ever go by that the full moon doesn't rise in the east as the sun is setting in the west, then you can know that God has given up on the Jews and will not fulfill his promises. But as long as the moon goes through its phases, as long as the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, God will not forget his promise and will not fail to fulfill it. Well, all this is very interesting. At least it is to me. I don't know if it is to you. But you may be wondering, does it have any significance for us today? And what in the world does it have to do with Election Day? Well, it does have significance for us. The first significance is this, that we stand with Israel. And we oppose all those who would deny their right to the land. Indeed, they deserve more land than they have. And one day God will give them all the land he has promised, from Iraq to the Mediterranean Sea. Second, it means that in all of life, and that includes Tuesday's election, we must be careful not to choose as Lot chose, based on what seems best for us personally, especially financially. The sad truth is, Genesis 13 teaches us why our nation is in the trouble that we're in. It's obvious that we're not a Christian nation. I'm not going to get into the discussion of whether we ever have been. I believe we were, but we no longer are. What nation that is truly Christian would allow the murder of unborn children to go on for 45 years, taking the lives of nearly 10 times as many people as the Holocaust in World War II? 10 times. Our nation. How can we call ourselves a Christian nation? What nation that is truly Christian would support the lifestyles that make abortion necessary? What nation that is truly Christian would continue to vote into office candidates who support the very policies that so many of us are upset with? Homosexual marriage, the removal of the Christian God from all public discourse, and gender confusion, among others. The only explanation that I can come up with is that come election day, the majority of Christians close their eyes to the values of faith, and all they can see is the dollar signs that this or that candidate promises. What else could be more important than life itself than a few extra dollars? What else could explain the fact that instead of our society adopting the basic values of God and the church becoming salt and light, instead the church has adopted the values of society and has become dark and has lost its flavor? Because our nation has valued personal choice and promises of personal gain above right and wrong, like Sodom, it is rebelling wickedly against Yahweh. And like Sodom, it is scheduled to be obliterated. People wonder why the United States is not in prophecy regarding the end times and the return of Christ. Could this be why? If God did not spare his own people, but judged Israel, if God did not spare his own temple, but let it be destroyed twice, because of child sacrifice and immoral living, why should the United States be any different? Those of us who reject the world's lust for ease and wealth at the expense of right and wrong will, like Abram, be saved during that destruction and kept safe in the midst of it. But it will be a time of testing for all, to be sure. But what a shame it is that we who have been given so much prosperity would turn our backs on God and forget the lessons of Torah. This day, whether it is election day or not, in our public lives and our private lives, in our actions and in our thoughts, in our own lives and in our interactions with others, the message of today's lesson is this: will we be Lot, fixing our eyes on what is seen? Or will we, like Abram, keep our eyes and our hearts on what is unseen? For as we all know, or should know, because God told us in his word, what is seen and all who build their lives on it will pass away. Only what is unseen, the invisible qualities of God, and those who value them and seek to apply them to their own lives, only these, will live forever. Heavenly Father, if it's not too late, I would pray that you forgive this nation for the way it has turned away from you. Yes, Lord, there have always been people in this nation since the Mayflower landed in Massachusetts. There have been people who came here for a variety of reasons that had nothing to do with faith in you. But there has always been a presence of people who have tried to follow your truth. It is for these people that I pray a prayer of repentance. If your people who are called by your name had lived their faith in the voting booth for the past 50 years, ours would be a very different nation than it is. But your own people have abandoned you. And for what? We have abandoned helpless victims to a death worse than any death given to a condemned criminal on death row. And while we care about their suffering and think that capital punishment is barbaric, we see nothing barbaric about violently taking away the life of an unborn child, even though ultrasound shows that only weeks after it has begun to live, it feels the pain of the abortionist tools. Because we do not hear the screams, we do not care. Father, forgive us. Open our eyes to what we must see, the rebellion of our nation against you. And even if it means living in poverty and wandering from place to place, may we be like Abram and discover, like Abram, that anywhere we go, you are with us. And if you are with us, we have all that we need. Through Christ we pray. Amen.